Blog Talk Radio.
Damn clock. Good evening and welcome to Eerie House Radio. Come on in. It's nice and, well, bloody in here, I guess. That's right. Our bloody weekend continues. This is Dale K here from Spook Show, and I'm here with...
a bloody mop with that in hand, Dave Binkley from Weird This Really Bad Movie and Spaceship One.
Cleaning up the evidence, and, are you?
I'm trying to before the police get here. You know, yeah. Just, by the way, Dale, been working on the last hour plus, but I have not one, not two, but 12 Dave Facts Blood Facts.
Oh, all righty. Good. Love when you jazz up the show with these Dave facts and assorted topic facts. This being our bloody weekend, that's perfect.
Yep. I got those around here. Okay, we're all set with that.
Hey, Serpent Society 9 is with us. So is Fogsbane. Welcome, folks. Or hi, yeah, as Fogsbane likes to say.
They're in for the bloodletting, are they?
Yes, indeed. And some of these one of these stories at least should chill your blood a little bit as we bring you, what do we have, suspense and an episode of Sherlock Holmes. Blimey.
Both of them, you got interesting shows. And, of course, our suspense has the very prolific actor, Mr. Joseph Cotten, in the lead. And that was the great thing about Suspense. It was Hollywood was not afraid to lend their stars to the Suspense program. Usually because also they'd get at the end, the announcer would also say what their current project or most recent project was. So it's a little bit of promotion for the project. It's always a good story and good writing, so they don't have to worry about besmirching their product. So it never a hard sell to let their actors or actresses go on to Suspense.
It's good PR too. So and it's great for us with so many available episodes of Suspense. That's one of the things. Them and CBS Radio Mystery Theater, Dave, with those two shows alone, we could probably go for another couple of years without repeating a single show.
Yep. If that's all there was, but there is so much more available, which really makes this an exciting journey.
Yep.
You look at all the Sherlock Holmes even, and all the different varieties. We've only had we've had three different Sherlock Holmes and Watsons along the route. There's still a couple of BBC ones we haven't touched yet. But we will at some point, because I think the first radio ones I heard were actually the ones with Sir John Gielgud and Sir Ralph Richardson as Holmes and Watson. And that's because they were available in my public library as a cassette. And although I was certainly aware of the movies with Nigel Bruce and Basil Rathbone, those in the Charlie Chan were things I got to watch a lot, because even in Buffalo, I probably have told this story before, but on Friday nights, my parents would go down to the Y and do square dancing, and they would leave us there, and my brother was quite a bit younger, so my sister and I would sneak down, turn on the TV, and there would always be, we didn't have any local horror hosts, but we had a mystery of on Friday nights. And we'd turn on the TV and watch it. It was either like one week it was Sherlock Holmes, and the next week it was a Charlie Chan movie. And we never got to see the end, because just as it was about to come to a conclusion, the lights would turn into the driveway. We'd shut off the TV, scamper upstairs, and pretend to be asleep. So we never actually got to see the end of those movies for several years.
Uh-oh. Parents, run for it.
yes.
Thanks. Yeah. Yep. When you're a kid, it's the parents. When you're an adult,
warning. Warning. It's the wife. Warning! Warning! It's the wife! It's the wife! Warning! Warning! It's
run
the wife!
It.
My goodness, quite a warning there.
Yes,
all right.
It is. A lengthy one at that.
Lots of, but so, yeah, that's my kind of story behind Sherlock Holmes, and I'm sticking with it.
I fortunately did get to see the end of some of those Sherlock Holmes thrillers on Channel 43, I believe, maybe even a few times on Channel 61 here in Northeast Ohio. Those were our UHF channels. There was VHF and UHF.
Yeah, anything beyond channel what? 12 was.
I think so. 12 or 13. I believe the dial went to 13, and then the other dial for your UHF, ultra high frequency, started at 14 and ran all the way up into the 80s, if I'm not mistaken.
I believe so. And there was no channel one. And
there was never a channel.
Why that was, right?
No, I don't.
Well, channel one was reserved for the military.
Ah.
So you could not even tune that in.
Yeah, their cartoons weren't that good. Except for Private Snafu.
There just weren't enough of those to fill too many Saturday mornings.
Yep. Well, last night we had to do it late, but this week, or tonight, right? We need to pay the bills, and you know, keeping in mind that this is Super Bowl weekend, we thought we'd theme our announcement for the Super Bowl.
Cool.
Bud Light presents Real American Heroes.
Real American Heroes.
Today we salute you, Mr. Male Football Cheerleader.
Mr. Male Football Cheerleader.
Real men don't just play smash mouth football. Real men turn cartwheels and somersaults on the sidelines, tucked safely away from the action.
Don't touch me now.
Fourth down and inches. The game's on the line. It all comes down to you. Will you call for a perky pyramid or a peppy line dance?
Get on my shoulder.
Knock 'em back, all the way to Hackensack. So grab an ice-cold Bud Light, Mr. Male Football Cheerleader. You may never score a touchdown, but you're peppy. That's gotta count for something. Bud Light Beer, Anheuser-Busch, St. Louis, Missouri.
And there's nothing good about Hackensack or New Jersey at large. In any event, we...
Hello, person. Don't touch me there.
Yeah, I know. I know the background singers make those even better. The announcer's great with his, you know, flat, you know, deadpan delivery, but the background singers make it. They make it. In the blowhole. go to the archive and listen to the last night's show, and you'll learn all about the donuts blowhole.
Yep, you will. And you'll wish you hadn't gone in. No, but you know you will. You'll get some great radio and a great Bud Light commercial about filling donuts.
Yes, as an occupation. Yet, why not? I would do it if it paid good.
Time
why not?
To make the donuts. Time to make the donuts.
There you go. Where will we start today?
Where should we start? You know what? Why don't we start with good old Sherlock Holmes? And I think you're the one that mentioned it last time. The amazing thing about Sherlock Holmes is throughout the story, the clues are all there, but it's never clear until Sherlock puts it all together at the very end of the program.
And oh, yeah. I love it. He even holds out on Watson. It's a surprise to Watson, too.
Yeah. And the cool thing about this one, if you loved the old Sherlock Holmes movies with Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce, not only are they both in here, but this is I had never heard Dennis Hooey, who played Lestrade in the movies, he actually came in here and he was Lestrade in this episode too. So this is kind of a cool episode because there's good old Lestrade as we know him from the movies.
And why not jump right in? This one's called, appropriately enough, Adventure of Missing Bloodstains. And it's from
May 15th, 1944.
And?
Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce in the new Adventures of Sherlock Holmes.
This rebroadcast is especially for the American Armed Forces and their allies. Now let's join Dr. Campbell as he enters Dr. Watson's study.
Here we are once again in Dr. Watson's study.
Come in, Mr. Campbell. Come in. Here, sit down and relax. You look a bit wilted, old fella.
Oh, yes, it's such a beautiful spring evening. I thought I'd walk over. In fact, it's so beautiful I dawdled most of the way, drinking in the warm air and the smell of things growing until suddenly I realized I was blame well going to be late if I didn't hurry. So I ran the last three blocks.
Yes, I know how it is. This lovely spring weather is certainly conducive to indolence. My household claim that when I go out to do the spring planting, I spend most of my time leaning on the spade, sniffing, and listening to the birds. Not an unpleasant way to pass the time of day, incidentally. Yes, a day like today is almost as relaxing as a Turkish bath. Which reminds me of a curious and gory experience that Holmes and I had in just such an establishment some years ago.
It sounds suspiciously like the gentleman who said bang. Oh, speaking of explosions.
Now, Mr. Campbell, you must never complain about the way that a storyteller begins his yarn. Anything is better than an abrupt beginning. Now, put me all out. Where was I?
In a Turkish bath, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, yes, a Turkish bath. You were not mistaken. Yes, that's it. Well, now, to begin at the beginning, it was in the hectic, hair-raising, and I might even say the glorious days of the great battle of wits between Sherlock Holmes and the notorious Professor Moriarty.
What you might call a real battle of the titans, eh, Doctor?
Indeed it was, Mr. Campbell. Things had been unusually hectic for Holmes for several months. Moriarty had been particularly active, and Holmes had had many sleepless nights. Finally, things had calmed down a bit, and I tried to persuade him to take a badly needed holiday. The net result being that he finally did agree to have an afternoon off and accompany me to a Turkish bath. As a matter of fact, both Holmes and I had a weakness for the Turkish bath. Over a smoke, in the pleasant latitude of the drying room, I've often found him less reticent and more human than at any other time.
The heat melted his cast iron reserve, eh, Dr. Watson?
Oh, only slightly, Mr. Campbell, only slightly. Well, as I was saying, on the upper floor of a certain Northumberland Avenue establishment, there is an isolated corner where two couches lie side by side. And it was on these that we were lying. Holmes had just shot his long, sinewy arm out of the towels which enveloped him and was fishing about in the inside pocket of his coat, which hung beside him.
Where have I put it? Where on earth did I put it? Oh, confound the thing. Watson.
Hmm?
I forgot to bring my tobacco.
Oh, relax, Holmes. Just relax. Forget about tobacco. Forget Moriarty and relax. That's what we came in here for.
Burble, 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 burble. I am relaxed, my dear fellow. But I want to smoke.
You mind about the burble, burble? Nothing like the peace and seclusion of a Turkish bath.
Mr. Holmes. Mr. Sherlock Holmes.
Hello? Gus, the steam room attendant. Seems to be paging you.
Oh, my goodness. Now what?
Has anyone seen Mr. Sherlock Holmes?
Why,
see in his face.
Here I am, Gus. Here I am. What do you want? Come on.
Oh, Mr. Holmes. It's good I find you. There has been an accident, Mr. Holmes. A bad accident. It's Lord Canterbury. He's in his dressing room, covered with blood.
Oh. In that case, I fancy you want Dr. Watson, don't you? Not me.
I'll be with you in a minute, Gus.
Oh, no, not Dr. Watson. It's too late for you. He's dead.
Dead?
Stabbed in six places. Come and look at him, Mr. Holmes, please.
Dead? Dear me. All right. I'll come at once.
Good gracious me. What's all the commotion? Why can't we have a little peace and quiet around? What's the meaning of this, Gus? Why are these two persons talking at the top of their voices?
My dear whoever you are, I was never under the impression that the Olympia Baths were a church. Furthermore, my dear Mr. Never mind the name.
Tunbridge. Frederick Hubert Tunbridge, a liberal leader in the present parliament, which everyone knows who keeps abreast of the time.
My dear Mr. Tunbridge, I do not concern myself with trivialities. Furthermore, as I was saying before being so rudely interrupted, you may be interested to know that your hated rival, Lord Canterbury, the Conservative leader with whom you are known to have publicly locked horns on several occasions...
What's he done now, the old fool?
If you mean Lord Canterbury, he's done absolutely... Yes, he hasn't done anything, and probably never will again.
What are you blithering about?
Well, it seems that Gus has just discovered your, shall we say, political vis-a-vis dead in his dressing room.
You mean he's had a heart attack?
No, I don't mean anything of the kind. He's been stabbed. In how many places did you say, Gus?
In 6 places, Mr. Holmes.
But that's impossible. I talked to him not half an hour ago. We had a little conference, Tub Rose, you understand, while he was waiting for Gus to come in and give him his batter. Well, he was quite all right, but I left him.
Oh, really? Are you sure?
What do you mean? Of course I'm sure. Canterbury was alive and cursing like a trooper when I left him. I passed Gus in the corridor. I came out of Canterbury's dressing room. He'll tell you the old boy was alive and kicking.
Oh, will he? How about it, Gus?
It is true, I hear swearing, but from which dressing room it comes, I could not be sure. The walls are so thin, you understand.
Yes, indeed. It's quite true, the dressing room walls are thin.
Gus, who is this person, and why is he asking all these stupid questions?
But Mr. Turnbridge, this gentleman is Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the famous detective.
I've never heard of him.
Got even with you there, Holmes.
well, send for Scotland Yard. This is a matter of national importance.
Quite, yes, I think you're quite right. You may as well send for Inspector Lestrade, Gus. Scotland Yard will have to be informed in any case. In the meantime, however, I think I'll take a look.
Well, in the meantime, Mr. Whoever you are, I insist that everything be left strictly alone.
Very well, then, Mr. Thingamabob, if you insist, but you'll be losing valuable time.
I most emphatically do insist.
Well, I'm getting out of here.
Me too. I'd like to have an appointment.
Well, if you can do without me, I think I'll
just... Oh, just a moment, gentlemen. Just a moment, if you please. I think it's only fair to point out to you all that suspicion is bound to fall on anyone who leaves before the authorities have had a chance to search and question him.
Touch me. Oh. You mean I have to be searched?
We seem to have stirred up quite a hornet's nest, eh, Watson?
Yes, and I brought you in here for a rest.
Well, Lestrade...
Nasty mess, eh, Mr. Holmes? Knife from the back.
Yes, not once, but 6 times. Deep, ferocious thrusts. Quite unnecessarily brutal. And, if I may say so, bloody.
Yeah. Place looks like a charnel house.
Yes, whoever did the deed must have been drenched in blood. Might tell your men to search for bloodstained towels or garments, will you, Lestrade?
Yes. Well, I'll pick up anything that's got blood on it. Never you fear, Mr. Holmes. I've ordered a search of everybody and everything on the premises.
Yes, that's not going to be very popular with Mr. Tunbridge, eh, Holmes?
Oh, I wouldn't care if he was the Archbishop of Canterbury. When Scotland Yard says search everybody, we search everybody. Besides, everybody knows he and the corpse here are bitter enemies. They fought like cat and dog. How long would you say he'd been dead, Mr. Holmes?
Oh, I don't know. About, an hour and a half. Took nearly 40 minutes to get you here, Lestrade. And Canterbury had been dead, let me see, over half an hour when Gus found him.
Gus, did the doorman notice who left the establishment during the half hour before the body was found?
Yes, sir. Only old Mr. Welford. And he's too feeble and nearsighted to do a crime like this.
Yeah. Was the door to Lord Canterbury's dressing room locked?
No, sir.
Huh? And how does it happen that he lay here for over half an hour before anyone found him?
Particularly as he was down on the books for a massage half an hour before he was found.
Well, you see, I thought he was asleep. Lord Canterbury sometimes he liked a little nap after he was in the steam room, and he didn't want I should disturb him.
Oh, that's very interesting.
Then you did come in this room once before you realized Lord Canterbury was dead.
Yes, Mr. Holmes. But he was lying there so peaceful.
So peaceful, yes. On his back?
Yes, sir. Just like we found him. It wasn't until the second time I come in I see he has his eyes open.
Mm-hmm. And the place is, shall we say, all spattered with blood?
It was so dark. The shades were drawn. It was not easy to see anything if you don't look close.
Even then, some people are unable to observe the most obvious facts.
And what might you mean by that?
Oh, just an observation, Lestrade. Just a gratuitous observation.
Come in. Well, Willis, what's up?
We've searched the place from top to bottom, just like you said, Inspector. And there's no bloodstains nowhere, except on this.
And what's that?
A pocket knife, sir. Large size.
Oh.
The handle's been wiped off, but there's still some bloodstains on the glide. We found it in the locker of a bloke, Nyme of Tunbridge.
Uh-huh.
Just a minute, Lestrade. Don't go off the deep end. Willis.
Yes, sir?
You say there were no bloodstains anywhere except on this knife.
Not a sign of a bloodstain nowhere.
You searched the dirty linen hampers, the towels and lockers, where the customers had their clothes?
Oh, yes, sir. We searched everything. There's not a sign of blood anywhere but on that there weapon.
Amazing. That's enough for me. This here is the murder weapon, and it was found in Tunbridge's locker. Bring him in here, Willis, and we'll have him on the carpet.
Yes, sir. Right away.
I knew he was the murderer from the beginning. Who has the motive for killing Canterbury? This chap Tunbridge. Who has the opportunity? This chap Tunbridge. He admits himself he had a talk with the deceased and they had words. And where is this here bloodstained knife found? Nowhere but in the this Mr. Tunbridge's locker.
Stupid place for a murderer to hide the fatal weapon in his own locker. Tunbridge isn't as stupid as that, Lestrade.
Oh, no? Then why was it there?
Look here, this is an outrage, keeping me here like this. Well, don't you realize I have influence? Well, you might at least let me put on my clothes instead of pawing them about. I'll complain to the authorities. I'll have you dismissed, all of you.
Oh, maybe you will, sir. And then again, maybe you won't. But first of all, you'll answer some questions. Have you ever seen this knife before?
Knife? Yes, of course. It's mine. I've had it all my life. I used to take it fishing when I was a boy.
Oh, indeed. That would explain its size, then.
Well, now I use it to open my letters.
Oh, you do? Are you sure that's all you use it for?
Yes, of course.
Then why are these here bloodstains on it?
Bloodstains?
Yeah.
Where?
Here and here. No, don't you touch it. We don't want to destroy any possible fingerprints.
But if it's mine, my fingerprints are already on it.
Yes, he's right there, Lestrade.
Oh.
Furthermore, that stain doesn't look like blood to me. It's not red enough. It looks like rust.
As a matter of fact, if a stain is a nice blood red, it's fairly certain it's not blood. Now, this particular stain,
you
as far as I see...
You leave this particular stain to Scotland Yard, Mr.
Yes. Don't forget, my dear Lestrade, I invented the first infallible test for blood stains.
That's quite true, Lestrade. He did.
Yes, indeed. My test is infallible. It works on blood that is new or on blood that is old. I discovered the first reagent, which is precipitated by hemoglobin.
I'm sorry, but Scotland Yard hasn't any time for lectures. We believe in action. Now, Mr. Tunbridge, it's my duty to take you into custody. And it's also my duty to warn you that anything that you may say may be used in evidence against you.
Anything I say? Yes. Do you realize whom you're arresting? I'm a leading figure in British politics.
So was this fellow who lies here stabbed with your knife, which has still got bloodstains on it.
Lestrade, if you'll pardon me for saying so, in this case, it's not the bloodstains that are in evidence, but the bloodstains that are not in evidence, which is the significant factor.
What do you mean by that?
Simply that it would have been rather difficult for Mr. Tunbridge to have committed a murder as gory as this one without having bloodstains on the towel he's wearing or on the clothes, which are still in his locker.
What was to prevent him from dropping his towel outside Lord Canterbury's dressing room, going in and knifing him in the back, then sneaking down to the shower rooms, not more than 20 feet down the corridor, and washing away the evidence?
Me going round about in the nude? Certainly not.
Most certainly not, sir. Remember, my dear Lestrade, as you dragged one of Britain's leaders away to jail, that it might have been possible for him to stab his enemy in a fit of temper, but he would never have dreamed of running up and down the corridors in his birthday suit. Let me see. I'm afraid I shall have to look for another explanation of the missing bloodstains.
And we can count on Basil to figure this one out and and to his own amusement, keep Watson baffled until the very end.
That's right. And this break is a good time to bring us our first of three sets of Blood Fact, Dave Fact. Woo-hoo!
Wait a minute, Dave.
Oh, I stick it in.
We need, we got something here. Wait a second. There we go.
Blood Fact. Nearly 7% of the human body weight is made up of human blood. Wow.
Wow.
Dave Fact, that's it. From now on, I'm only drinking Blood Light. 2, Blood Fact. High blood pressure implies a risk of stroke and heart attack. Dave Fact, I don't have high blood pressure. I give it. Blood Fact. Donated blood plasma can be stored for 1 year in a frozen condition. Dave Fact. But if they give that to you, it could make you cold-blooded. Blood Fact. The adult body has 60,000 miles of blood vessels running through the body. Dave Fact. 60,000 miles. But when they try to take mine, they can never find a vessel. Woo! That's it for this set.
Okay.
Have you ever had the problem of not finding a vein, Dale?
No. They always tell me you have good veins. You're easy.
Yeah, I've heard you're easy, but I didn't know it had anything to do with your blood.
Well, it does that. And that, too, yes. The answer is always yes.
Yeah.
I cannot tell a lie to anyone that knows better. good story. And I love that's the other thing is he's way, way, way ahead of Scotland Yard too at all times.
Yes. And in this, Dennis Hooey, who you have such a fun time with his name. Actually has 78 actor credits, appearing from first one in 1927, the last one in 1957, and he passed away in 1960. A lot of them were just, well, most of the 50s were just TV series appearances, but there were still a David and Bathsheba in 1951. He was in Caribbean in 1952, and Plymouth Adventure 1952 also. Most of the rest of the 1950s were all television for him. But up until 1950, it was all movies. And of course, his first one was 1927, so it wasn't a sound movie, so you couldn't hear his accent. So he was better when they got sound.
Yep. Plenty of time to learn some English. English? Why not?
Yep, why not?
And let's continue then with Sherlock Holmes in The Adventure of the Missing Bloodstains.
Holmes, it's late. Everyone else has left the Turkish bar.
Everyone but the faithful Gus.
Oh, I don't mind. Tonight we have by my house sauerkraut.
I don't like sauerkraut.
Besides, I've got to stay and lock up.
Then you'll have to wait till we find the bloodstains. They're here somewhere. That's why I sent home for my famous benzidine peroxide mixture. Somewhere on the premises there is a towel or linen or something that has bloodstains.
Oh, but we've been through the towels and the linen a dozen times, Holmes. No sign of blood. Furthermore, according to the establishment's checklist, there are no towels or any linen missing. Even Gus, his linen, which he washes himself, is hung here on the line.
You don't wash any linen but your own, do you, Gus?
No, Mr. Holmes. Everything go out to the laundry. Mm-hmm. I wash my own because I'd like to be fresh and clean. Twice a day I wash, noon and evening.
Mm. Yes. The evening's job hasn't been done yet, eh?
No. This one I washed this noon. It's my towel from this morning.
Oh, yes. This morning's towel washed this noon. Yes. But was it?
Canterbury was murdered in the middle of the afternoon about 3:30. Now it's now after 7 o'clock. Don't you see, Watson? This towel. Don't you see?
No, Holmes, I don't. I don't see a blasted thing. The towel's as clean as a whistle.
But not dry. If it had been washed at noon, it would be dry now. But it's still damp. Yes, it was washed after Canterbury's death.
Of course, to remove the bloodstains.
Gus?
Yes, Mr. Holmes.
That's why you didn't report the death until half an hour after Canterbury had died.
Oh, no.
You had to have time to remove the bloodstains.
That's not true. Besides, you can't prove anything. The towel is clean now. There are no marks, no stains.
The very fact that there were no stains on it, Gus, at first made me suspect you. Lord Canterbury was found lying on his back. And yet, when you informed us that he had been stabbed, you were quite definite about the number of times that he'd been stabbed. But in the back.
Yes?
Yes. How did you know that, Gus?
Well, I lift him up and I look.
Of course, I see what you're getting at, Holmes. He couldn't have done that. No one could examine the corpse without getting blood all over himself.
And yet, when Gus appeared to tell us of Canterbury's death, there wasn't a spot of blood on him. But if I can prove that this towel, which you so carefully washed, once had bloodstains, and that you were very careful to remove those stains...
That you will never prove. I have scrubbed, I have used soap, I have even boiled that towel. There is not even a suspicion of a bloodstain left.
That is where you're wrong, my friend. Watson, run the water into this tub, will you? No matter how thoroughly you try to remove a bloodstain, it will never... out. Damned spot. Yes, we only need enough to moisten the cloth. Now I'll drop a few drops of my famous solution onto the cloth. There we are.
Well, all I can see is a lot of pale blue streaks.
Yes, it's undoubtedly blood.
Blood?
Yes, the curious blue streaks prove infallibly that there was blood on the towel. And now, Gus, are you going to explain why you were so anxious to remove these bloodstains?
No, I did not do it. It was Mr. Turnbridge. He did it. The knife was his knife. There was blood on it. Let me out of here. It's not my fault. I don't want to hurt.
Holmes, he's running away.
Watch him, Watson. We can't get him to escape.
Well, there he goes down the corridor.
He's gone into the steamroom.
Don't worry. I'll get him. Phew. The steam's thick in here. I can hardly see my hand before my face.
Must be in here. Look under the benches, Watson. Watson, leave the door open. Let some of this blasted steam out of here, will you?
I didn't shut the door. Holmes, you hear that?
The door. Someone's locked the door.
Hey, somebody, let us out. Let us out, you hear? We're locked in. We've been locked in by mistake.
No, you're wrong. It was no mistake, my friend.
Holmes, Moriarty. He's here in the steam room with us.
No, that's just his voice through the ventilator. So you were behind this murder too, Professor.
Of course. Perhaps you would like to know why I had to kill Lord Canterbury.
Yes, indeed. That would be very interesting.
Good. I found it necessary to start a feud between the two great political parties because they're in danger of forming a coalition to pass certain housing reforms that would have proved very expensive to me. Well, what better way to break up an incipient collaboration than by killing one leader, having the other hanged for his murder?
A very ingenious, Moriarty. A pity you should have chosen such a clumsy tool as Gus.
Clumsy? Perhaps. But he fooled Scotland Yard, Mr. Holt. It was just my ill luck that you should be on the premises when the accident occurred.
Oh, thank you for the compliment.
Not at all. However, it's a mistake which I'm sure Gus will be able to rectify.
Gus? How?
Very simple. I have sent him to put more coals on the fire. Any moment now, there should be more steam. Yes, gentlemen, much more steam. I'm afraid that when you finish with this steam bath, you will never need another. No. You will be boiled alive.
He's right there. There comes the steam pouring out of the opening over our heads. If only we could reach that opening, we could stuff some of these towels into the pipeline and cut off the flow.
But Lord Holmes, it's getting very hot in here.
Wait. I have it. One of the long benches. I'll stand on the end. You'll have to balance it while I climb on the top. Talk, Watson. Make a noise. Anything to cover up the moving of the bench.
Oh, very well. Oh, it's getting hot. Moriarty, this has gone far enough. We can't stand much more of this.
Steady, Holmes. Now hand me up a towel, quick.
Moriarty, turn the steam off. You hear, Moriarty, can't you hear? The heat, it's becoming unbearable.
Yes, more towels, Holmes.
Is it getting hot enough in there, gentlemen Boyle? I'm sure it is. Boiled nice and pink, boiled in steam, live steam. Goodbye, Mr. Sherlock Holmes.
Now what happened? You can't stand up there all night, Holmes.
Someone has to. Pressure's terrific. Huh? Very lucky. It may soon become so great that it may burst the boiler.
But that's dangerous. Buildings have been known to collapse because of bursting boilers.
Nevertheless, it's our one chance. If only the confounded boiler bursts before my arm is snapped in
but
two.
Holmes, your arm isn't as strong as the boiler plate.
Pressure, my dear Watson. Measured per square foot of air surface. Quite a bit of surface to a boiler. The opening of this pipe is fairly small. All the same, I'm afraid I can't hold out much longer, Watson.
Hold on, Holmes, hold on. It must burst soon, it must.
The pressure. My hands. Look out.
And you came through the explosion all right, Dr. Watson?
Well, I had a nasty crack where Holmes and the bench fell on me, and Holmes had the wind knocked out of him, but we were in fairly good shape by the time the fire brigade pulled us out from the wreckage.
Moriarty wasn't by any chance trapped or killed or something?
Unfortunately, no. But they found Gus, however, quite dead.
I suppose the exploding boiler did for him.
No, there was a bullet wound in the back of his head. I rather imagine that Moriarty wanted to make sure that he would never appear in court.
Doctor, if I had to go through what you went through in that Turkish bath episode, I think I'd never want to work on another case with Holmes again.
Oh, come now, Mr. Gamble. I certainly did feel like that for a couple of hours. But by the time we got back to Baker Street and sat down to one of Mrs. Hudson's good meals, well, I was ready for anything that Holmes had in mind. You know, there's nothing like a good dinner to make you feel a new man.
You have been listening to An Adventure in Crime with Basil Rathbone as Sherlock Holmes and Nigel Bruce as Dr. Watson.
Treat having Peter Lurie there at the very very nice.
Yeah, that was again. It was one of the Mystery Playhouse. So they took certain programs, made sure there weren't any commercials in them, and Peter Lorre was one of the hosts, and Howard Duff was one of the hosts, and the guy just called Mr. X was one of the hosts for those particular programs. But they were already pre-produced programs.
Mm-hmm. And fine ones at that. Nice.
Yep.
Nice episode of Sherlock Holmes with Basil.
And of course, there is something you can learn from that.
I can't imagine.
Believe it or not.
I can't imagine it. Eerie House Radio proudly presents A Garrulous Moral of the Story.
With gobs of apologies to Garrulous.
Gobs.
You should never get Sherlock Holmes steamed. That should be saved for the clams. There you go.
Okay.
There we are.
Johnny Weissmuller approved.
Okay. Well, you know, if Johnny Weissmuller approved, then, you know, it just give you one swing in time then.
There you go. And that's just one of the two fine tales we have for you tonight that are nice and gooey and bloody.
That's true, because what's coming up next is none other than a tale well calculated to keep you in suspense. Yeah. Okay, Dale.
That's better than not being in suspenders.
Your microphone's starting to cut in and out on you, so if we lose you, you have to call back.
That's right.
Yep.
Love that blog talk. Hey, CW joined us. Thanks for listening live along with Fogs and Serpent Society 9 and billions others that we can't see, touch, or smell their hair or anything like that.
So true.
Ah, suspense. One of the shows of classic radio.
Shall we do another set of Blood Facts, Dave Facts before we get going here?
Well, we could if there was that, you know, exciting introductory music, of course, which...
Oh, well, forget it then.
We can... Or, as an alternative...
Ooh, ah. I'll take that as a cue.
Yes.
Blood facts. There are artificial hearts, but there is no such thing as artificial blood. Dave fact, my ex-wife divorce lawyer didn't believe that and tried to get that too. Let's see. Blood fact. Our body has about 0.2 milligrams of gold, and most of it is in our blood. Dave fact, see, my boss is wrong then. I'm not completely worthless. Blood fact, nearly 2 million red blood cells in the human body die every 1 second. Dave fact, I guess it goes to make more room for my Mountain Dew. There we go. Blood fact, 1,200,000 mosquitoes need to suck blood from a human body at one time to drain all the blood from a body. Dave fact, and yet it only takes one lawyer to do the same.
There you
exactly.
go.
Exactly.
That was us kicking the lawyer out.
Here we go.
Yes. And this one, the next our next episode of Suspense here is called Blood Sacrifice. Ooh.
Sorry, CW.
Yes. Billions and billions. All right, so tell us a little bit about this episode. Who can we expect to hear? And
you hear the wonderful actor Mr. Joseph Cotten, who had an extremely long career in the theater to radio to the films. He was part of Orson Welles' original Mercury Theater, and so he went from Broadway to the movies. I'm sure he did some radio with Orson, although he didn't do any of the shadow with Orson, but and clear up into I think the 60s he was even still busy. I'll have to look that up in between there. Things a little bit about Joseph Cotten there, but he had quite the prolific career and always seemed to be able to find work at any time in his career.
Yeah, I mean, generally known as an American actor, but he was in a great, predominantly British film, Dr. Fibes.
Okay.
He was one of the doctors that Fibes was trying to get even with. As I recall. Yep. And am I still here? All right, which one of us can you hear? Folks, let us know in the chat. I think it's me. Poor Dave is gone, but he'll be back soon. He'll be dialing in just like you can at 646-378-0264. And join us, or join me. Bail me out. I'm all alone. Hopefully Dave will be back in just a moment. While we wait for Dave, let's just go ahead and get with suspense. Gosh, you know, if only Dave was here, I'd know the original broadcast date.
It would be March 30th, 1950. Thank you, Blog Talk.
And its 96,000 dealers present Mr. Joseph Cotton in Blood Sacrifice, a suspense play produced and edited by William Spear.
Hap, me boy, here's one that'll rattle the ivory between your ears. What is it that carries water, has plates, gives continuous service, and is associated with a good tip? A waiter. Oh, how dumb can you be? Listen, I'll make it easy. It needs water only 3 times a year in normal car use. And it's a tough little bundle of potent energy. Now, what is it?
Camel?
Oh, give me strength. Look, Slap Happy, it's the famous Autolite Stay Full battery. The battery that needs water only 3 times a year in normal car use. Why, the Stay Full has over 3 times more liquid reserve above the plates than batteries without Stay Full features.
You caught me with my brains down, Wilcox.
Glad to hear you admit it. Because the Autolite Stay Full battery is known from coast to coast as the battery that gives 70% longer average life as compared to batteries without Stay Full features. And this is proven by tests conducted according to SAE life cycle standards.
You're absolutely right, Harlow.
Of course. You're always right with Autolite.
And now, with Blood Sacrifice and the performance of Joseph Cotton, Autolite hopes once again to keep you in suspense.
Me in his dressing room. Gary, his arm through mine, his great, beautiful voice purring assuringly in my ear.
It's wonderful, Johnny, wonderful. 200,000. Why, they didn't pay that for Gone with the Wind. You're a success, boy, a success.
A success. And well on the way toward being rich. On the marquee above the theater in lights, Garrick Drury in Bitter Laurel, and then in slightly smaller lights by John Scales. New clothes, best food, a fashionable hotel, new and fashionable acquaintance. And I owed it, every bit of it, to Garrick Drury. Everyone said that, everyone except Gary. We'd just finished seeing the men from the motion picture company. Gary had been charming, courteous, thoughtful, protecting my royalties, protecting his rights. And finally, they were gone. Walters, Gary's valet, came into the room.
Anything else, Mr. Drury?
Not tonight. I'll pick you up in the car at the stage door at 5 minutes.
Yes, sir.
I'm going to see Mr. Scales for his taxi. Sure, I can't drop you anywhere, John.
No, quite sure, thanks.
Glad to, you know. Oh, well, Walters.
Oh, yes, sir.
Bring along that play of young, what's his name, Ruggles, Buggles, you know who I mean. I promised Fanny Taylor I'd read it, but, well, it's perfectly useless, of course. We'll be playing Bitter Laurel for another 2 or 3 years yet. Eh, what, John? Well, come on. 5 minutes, Walters.
Yes, sir.
Now, look here, John. Don't you worry about this movie deal. I've handled these characters before. Before! Listen to that, John. Wonderful sound. The empty theater. The empty, echoing, endless theater. John, you know what?
Sure. There's a play in it. In the last scene, the actor dies in the empty, endless theater, pouring out his death on 8 pages to the ghosts of all the audience who didn't realize how great he was.
Alone. His wife's gone to,
Hollywood.
Perfect. Well, what are we waiting for, Johnny? I'll put you in your taxi. You go home and write it. Bring it to me tomorrow night. We'll fix it, and there we are.
I can read the notices now.
It's sensational, aren't they?
Garrick Drury does it again. Actor's death scene draws Bravo.
Sir Garrick Drury, maybe. Well, come on. We'll get you on your way.
Good night, Mr. Drury. Thought your performance was exceedingly fine tonight.
Thank you. Good night, Scotty. Waters will be right out. You can lock up.
Good night, Mr. Drury, Mr. Scales.
Good night, Scotty.
Well, this is thrilling. There's a cab stand right at the corner. We make a run for it. John, look out!
Hold there.
Are you all right?
I don't know. Knocked the breath out of me. My side. How about you? You all right?
No.
Here, let me help you. Bye.
You are hurt.
No. Just jarred up a little. No broken bones. Gary. Oh, my Lord. I picked myself up from the curb where the car had thrown me when it hit us. My side hurt and my head reeled, but Gary. I saw him stagger out from the other side of the car, saw the jagged pane of broken glass in the store window, saw the bright spurt dyeing the pavement crimson where Gary's right hand clutched his left arm. A policeman came running for us.
Here, what happened?
It's Mr. Dury, officer. The car skidded over the curb and knocked him through the window.
Here, let's have a look now.
Hey, no, catch him, he's going faint.
They've got him now. Oh, no wonder. He's got an artery. Hey, you, call an ambulance. Get a doctor. This man will bleed to death if we're not quick. Are you all right, sir?
I hurt the side a little, Paul. I feel a bit faint, but I'll be all right.
Good. We've got to stop this bleeding here. Now, help me. You put your hand right here. That's right. Yeah. Now, squeeze hard.
Yeah.
And keep on squeezing. You over there. Come on, give us a hand. I'll take his head. You take his feet now.
Right.
Easy, does it? Up.
What happened? Mr. Drury.
It's been an accident. Oh. Walter, here. Come, give me a hand.
Oh. Hang on to the artery now.
I'm trying to now.
What is it, Mr.
Accident. Mr. Drury cut an artery. Here. There's a couch in Mr. Drury's dressing room off. They're right around this way.
What's the matter? Oh. What happened to the light?
Turn up the light.
He fainted, Gary.
Oh. All right. Here on the couch. Easy now. Down we go. Now, you, get an ambulance and a doctor.
All right.
My left arm, ain't you? You suppose I'll lose the use of it? Lord. Well, it's lucky it's the arm in the play, isn't it, John? I can always go on playing chief. Always. The rest of my life.
My play. All the rest of his life. Because of the blood, I began to be sick. And the officer took his strong hand and gripped the artery in Gary's arm above my own shaking fingers.
Now, you look peaky. Lie down, Mr. Scales. Let me over. Now, you, help rig up a tourniquet. Well, Walters, whatever your name is. Will someone try to get a doctor?
Just call for the doctor. There's no one on emergency. Everyone's out, and so are the ambulances.
Then call a private hospital. This man is bleeding to death.
Bleeding to death. This was the end, was it? No doctor on duty, and Gary Drury bleeding to death. And I came too. I'll find a doctor. But it was 40 minutes before the doctor finally came. 40 minutes while Gary Drury's life seeped out from the improvised tourniquet. The doctor set down his bag and took one look.
We're still trying to get hold of an ambulance, Doctor.
Oh, never mind. We couldn't move him now anyway. There's only one thing to do. Give him a transfusion right here. Yes. Well, first we'll make a decent tourniquet. I'll test his blood for type. Oh, by the by, wait around, all of you. I have to find someone among you with type of blood that matches his.
Gary lay on a couch behind a screen in his dressing room. And there was a plate on the table, one with a border of pink roses from which, during rehearsals, we'd often eaten hasty sandwiches. Now there were four round blobs of red on it. Blood. Two blobs of mine and two of Gary's valet, Walters. Behind the screen, Walters was blubbering with grief while an intern arrived at last with the ambulance, was murmuring fearfully.
But, Doctor, I can't find his pulse.
You can't. What? Wait a minute. Here, you idiot, let me see. Yes, of course, here it is. But we must hurry or we'll be gone. Steady now, Walter, steady. We know you love him. We're doing all we can. Now, go look at those tests. The important thing is to give transfusion as soon as possible.
Oh, let me give it, I'll give my life for Mr. Drury. Let me give the transfusion.
No, please. We'll see. I've already told you Drury's blood is type 3, very difficult. Can only give him a transfusion from someone of his own type, or a type 4 universal donor. Anything else would be like giving him prussic acid. I only hope that you or Mr. Scales will do. We'll have to make sure. All right, now let me see.
The doctor bent over the plate, pouring liquid out of vials onto the red drops. I stood where I'd been standing when he put the blood onto the plate before the intern's voice had cried out.
Doctor, I can't find his pulse.
Walters and the doctor had plunged around the screen to where Gary lay unconscious. I watched while the doctor finished with the vial. Then he picked up a grease pencil from the dressing table and drew a line across the plate, cutting it in half. Then with a pencil, he marked the side on which I stood with an S and the side on which Walters had stood with a W.
There now. Now we'll be sure of which is which. It will take a few minutes to see if there's any agglutination. Oh, let's hope. That's all we can do is hope.
And he disappeared once again behind the screen. It was then that I noticed the one rose on the border of the plate which had been blurred in the firing. I'd noticed it before. Many times I'd noticed it today in the last few minutes, looking stupidly at it, as you do at such things. But before the doctor had marked it, before he and Walters had gone running behind the screen, then hadn't the blurred rose been on the left, my left? But now it was on the right. Might Walters, in passing, have brushed it and turned it around? I stood and stared at the tiny pool on the side marked W. Little hard purple crystals were beginning to form around the edges. I looked at the side of the plate marked S, my side, supposedly. The blood was clear and bright. But what if the plate had been turned around? And the blood on the other side was mine. It was mine that was forming little purple crystals. I stood staring at the plate as the doctor came around from behind the screen.
Now, let's have a look at this. Well, looks as though we're in luck.
Is it mine? May I give him the transfusion, sir?
Sorry, old man. Not unless you want to murder him.
Oh.
No, but Mr. Scales here, it looks as if he were that useful animal, a universal donor. Mm-hmm. All right, Mr. Scales, let's make ready.
What?
You're it, Mr. Scales.
There's something I ought... I ought to mention that...
You're not frightened, are you?
Not that...
You're in danger from giving a transfusion, you know.
No,
the donor, that
no,
is.
No, I'm not
then
frightened,
come around
doctor.
Here and let's get busy. We haven't much time.
Doctor, I...
Hello, John, old fellow. What's this? Final curtain?
Oh, don't be silly.
Such a rotten exit. Dying, Egypt. Dying.
Oh, yeah. Not dead yet, not by a long shot.
Now take off your coat, Pete, Mr. Scales, and roll up your sleeves.
Rotten exit. Rotten break for you, too, John. You'll have to close the play.
Close the play. I'm ready, Doctor.
To be sure. Now, sit down here. Hold still. You will hardly notice this. Make a fist.
Like
tight.
This?
That's it. Maybe feel a little dizzy for a minute afterward, but in an hour, you'll be as right as rain.
That's all right.
Now, still. There.
Yeah.
Not bad, was it? Lie back. That's right.
Good old John. Give me... Lord, what a publicity story this will make. Playwright at actor's bedside gives blood to save famous star's life.
If he had kept quiet, if he'd only... It might not have been too late then. But then I knew that I would never tell the doctor. I would never tell anyone. I would only wait and see. The revulsion, the contempt, the hatred that had been caged up in me for that smiling, posturing ape on the couch leaped now, clawing at the bars, howling for revenge.
Going all right, Scales?
Yes. Yes, perfectly. Thank you, Doctor.
Is bringing you Joseph Cotton in Blood Sacrifice. Tonight's production in radio's outstanding theater of thrills, Suspense.
Well, we got a nice little build up here for this one.
Not near suspenseful as knowing when Blog Talk Radio is going to throw us off.
Yeah, that would be nice to know. That's the mystery. That's the mystery part of our show, folks. When will Blog Talk kick us to the curb?
Hey, did a little bit of look up on Joseph Cotton during the show here, and his second full movie that he did was, of course, Citizen Kane, and two movies later, he'd also worked with Orson Welles again on Magnificent Ambersons. He would also work with him on, of course, one of CW's favorites, The Third Man. He also worked for Hitchcock in The Shadow of a Doubt, and he was in the MGM version, American version of Gaslight. For movies and television, he has 133 credits. His last being in 1981. He had two in 1981. One of them was on an episode of Love Boat. He also was in two Tales of the Unexpected. He was on Fantasy Island twice.
You played.
Also, yeah, that's right. He was also in Airport 77, one of those great airport disaster movies. Actually, a couple of them, because he was also in Concord Affair 79. And everything from the Rockford Files to TV movies to Lady Frankenstein to Abominable Mr. Fibes, as you mentioned. Just so many. So many that he even had his own TV series. Ah, I guess he was a semi-regular. He was in, five or six episodes of it, Takes the Thief, with Robert Wagner. And episode of 77 Sunset Strip, Dr. Kildare, and had his own TV show. Lasted a whole 14 episodes. So the Joseph Cotten Show on trials.
Yes.
So there you go.
Robert Wagner always reminds me of my favorite joke. What kind of wood doesn't float? All right, let's move along to...
Oh, no, stop.
I'm probably going to get chastised now because I believe I know who just joined us here on the radio.
OMG, Dale.
You knew that was coming, Dave. And who are you? Dale.
Yes.
And you deserve it. Yes. You deserve it.
Well, if you think that's bad,
okay.
take a dollar bill. I'm going to use a piece of paper for this exercise. But take a dollar bill and pop it like this. That's the last thing Vic Morrow heard. Or as I like to call him, Morrow. Oh, come on, Dale. Stop it.
Oh my!
Meow.
Ouch.
Wolf.
Ouch!
I know I'm bad.
Oh, does anyone have a Band-Aid?
For my mouth, probably. Duct tape. How are you enjoying our show tonight, Ms. W?
I am very well, and in need of giving you the link to Miss Manners, How to Not Behave on a Podcast. But
starring me. Oh, gosh.
Starring you with a cameo appearance.
Well, I pulled an OMG earlier in one of my Blood Facts, Dave Facts 2, Dale. So don't feel left alone there.
Okay.
No, you're in superb company. You're in superb company by all means. And I was just wondering, did Joseph Cotten ever do a night gallery?
It seems to me he did. No?
It would have been about 1970-ish. Let me running there. Name of the Game. Keen. It Takes Thief. Playhouse Grasshopper, The Virginian. Do You Take the Stranger? No, I do not see him in credits as in a night gallery. It doesn't mean it wasn't. I'm just saying.
Because I distinctly remember him. It was an odd sort of little quirky episode. Spoiler alert. He collects an old painting, scrapes off the top of it, and finds a rather, shall we say, risque image of an ex-flame of his who finds a way to get back at him by a little bit of poison, a little bit of strychnine, a little bit of arsenic, a little bit of hemlock. She just offs the guy. But does it very tastefully, of course.
Of course, yes. Yeah, I don't see here, but, you know, I do kind of recall that. And he may have been, you know, of course, IMDb, they can miss things, and that's why people add to it
mm-hmm.
all the time. So
either that or was it Tales of the Unexpected? That
well, yeah,
Ronald Dahl?
He was in several Tales of the Unexpected. Let me get down there.
What was it?
Departed in Peace and Edward the Conqueror. Departed in Peace.
That sounds more like it. Departed
yeah.
in Peace.
An unconventional artist, art dealer, Lionel, gets run to visualize Lionel's fiancée, Janet, nude and paint her accordingly. Janet, however, does not see the joke, for which Lionel pays bitterly in a literally sense. Ooh.
Yeah.
There you go.
See, that will figure, we'll help you figure stuff out, folks.
Indeed, mystery solved, those meddling
yep.
kids.
If we don't know it, if we can't find it, we'll make it up.
Absolutely.
Yes, I'm being very naughty, and it's a good thing CW came in just in time to keep me in check.
Yeah,
indeed.
I didn't help. It didn't work. It didn't work.
We keep slogging through it. We'll just keep slogging on, soldiering on, but we'll just keep shaking our head and just keep soldiering on.
And that we shall do. And we'll maybe, we'll have time for a little bonus feature here at the end as we wrap up Blood Sacrifice from Suspense.
And now, Autolite brings back to our Hollywood soundstage our star, Joseph Cotton, in Blood Sacrifice, a tale well calculated to keep you in suspense.
I lay back there on the chair in the dressing room. The doctor had been right. There was no pain about it. I could feel little tinglings as the blood said goodbye to my body on the way to inhabiting the much bluer veins of a distinguished actor. No, I felt nothing. Only a gentle warmth after a while and a lovely serenity. And with it came little visual effects inside my closed eyelids, a kaleidoscope like they use in films to dissolve into flashbacks. That was it. Yes. I was having a flashback. I hadn't wanted to send the play to Gary in the first place, but I was new in London and good old George Philpotts, who was handling me, said he had a hunch about it.
Everything to gain, my boy. Nothing to lose. May as well try, you know. Can't get hurt trying.
Lord George, Gary Drury, it's just not his kind of play. It's a tragedy, a bitter, cynical, disillusioned tragedy.
Well, he may. He just may like it, you know. I'll send it along over to his hotel. We'll see.
I'd never met Gary until then, and of course, this tremendous charm of his, this flashing, winning, infectious, incomparable style of the man. When you talked to him, you were lost. And he did like the play. At least he said he liked it.
Oh, yes, wonderful idea. Very strong. Perhaps a little grim, but then these are grim times. Of course, there are one or two things that need touching up, and we may have to make a change here and there. There's never been a play produced that didn't have to have a certain amount of rewriting during rehearsal. You understand.
But I didn't understand. I was still too bewildered to understand. And the man had this fantastic charm, and he'd used it. Before I was out of his office, I'd signed a contract giving me a very pretty share of the royalties, and Gary the right to make any reasonable changes he might deem necessary to the script. Reasonable changes. During rehearsals, we'd sit halfway back in the theater, and...
Oh, John, I've been thinking.
Yes?
Cocktail scene in the first act. It bothers me. It seems out of character.
What do you mean?
Keith wouldn't have acted that way. He'd have been shocked and hurt and angry at the change in his fiancée. He'd have denounced her and left the party. Wonderful thing, you want? And then at the very end, Keith rolls up his uniform tunic with all the decorations on it and lays it under his head for a pillow and lies down on the bench. Oh, wonderful curtain line. He said, "I rest upon my laurels." Wonderful. Can you write it, boy?
You're not serious.
Of course I'm serious. Now, look here, Johnny, this is your play. I'm only conservative.
But that's not the play, Gary. It's all out of key with the rest of it.
Oh, yes, that reminds me. I've been a little bothered about the ending, too. Oh, it's very dramatic, of course, but just at this time, it seems in a little bad taste, don't you think?
The play, altered, butchered, finally opened. We sat up waiting for the morning papers, and then they came. I read them, and I wanted to run away and couldn't. The voices of the critics saying to the public,
"This broken back play is only held together by the magnificent acting of Mr. Garrick Drury."
Saccharine as it is, bitter laurel provides a personal triumph for Mr. Garrick Drury.
Nothing in the play is consistent except the assured acting of Garrick Drury.
Mr. John Scales has constructed his situations with great skill to display Mr. Drury in all his attitudes, and that is a sure recipe for success. We prophesy a long run for Bitter Laurel.
And run it did. There was no stopping it. I caught myself wishing Garrick Drury would die or lose his looks or his voice or his popularity so that the whole thing could be buried and forgotten. Well, now, perhaps he was going to die. I watched the blood from my veins fill up the container. I thought of the blurred rose on the plate that might have got turned around. I heard Walter still complaining about something. I listened to the doctor.
Oh, blood won't do at all, Walter. Lucky for Mr. Drury that Mr. Scales is around. Good man to have around. Universal donor. Blood mixes with all types.
But was it my blood or Walter's that mixed with all types? I didn't know. I couldn't be sure. Yet somehow I was sure that the plate had been turned around, and that would mean that if the doctor used my blood for a transfusion, that... What was it he said? It would be like giving Gary prussic acid. It would be murder. No one would ever know. The doctor might guess, but he would never dare speak. It would be put down to his own negligence. He came over to me and looked at the level in the container and nodded his head approvingly and turned to Gary again. I felt myself pulsing and drifting like a man dozing in a snowdrift.
Flower for your lapel, sir. Flower for your lapel.
Good evening, Buddy.
Oh, good evening, Mr. Drury. Looks like rain, don't
it? It does indeed. But then we can't complain. Well, John, you must let me run.
Yes, sir. Take a flower.
Thank you, Flory. The show must go on, you know.
Bless you. Oh, good evening, Mr. Scales.
Flory, they have a carnation.
Yes, sir. 2 shillings, sir.
Mm-hmm. Here you are.
Send it on for you.
Oh, thank you.
It's wonderful about your play, Mr. Scales. It's been a wonderful run. But then Mr. Drury does know how to pick them.
Yes, yes. It looks as if it might run forever, doesn't it?
No matter what he's in, they all come to see him. Not that yours isn't a wonderful play. Mr. Drury gave me a ticket for the second night.
Oh, it's...
He's always so thoughtful.
Oh, what'd you think of it?
I thought it was lovely. I cried ever so when Mr. Drury came back with only one arm and found his fiancée with that other fellow at the cocktail party.
Exactly.
I will rest on my laurels. That was a beautiful curtain line you gave him there, Mr. Scales, and the way you put it over.
Yes, there's no one like Drury to put over that kind of line. Good evening, Flory.
Oh, good evening, Mr. Scales.
Bitter Laurel. Oh, good Lord, Molly, Sheridan, hello. It's good to see you. It's been months.
Look who's here. New York's rising drama.
Oh, no, don't. Have you seen it? I sent you tickets.
Yes. Kind of you to think of us in your busy life. Yes, we saw the show.
Oh, I know. But like a fool, I signed a contract without a controlling clause, and by the time Drury and his producer had finished knocking the script around, there wasn't
much... John. It's a shame.
Now, look, let's forget the play and go have a drink together, shall we?
Oh, sorry, Opa. We have to think of our reputations, you know. Good night, John. Go along, Sherry. John?
Molly?
John, it was a good play. How under any circumstances could you have let them do this to it? Come along, Sherry.
Good night, John.
Yes.
Good night,
John. Good night.
Hi. Almost full court. That ought to do it. Feel all right, Mr. Scales?
Yes.
Good. Now we'll throw you out of here and go to work.
The doctor ushered me out of the room onto the stage. I saw him disappearing around the screen with a flagon in his hands as I closed the door. Just as I thought. There were the reporters waiting. I sat down. I felt weak. Not right at all.
Mr. Scales, how is he?
Yes,
will he live, do they think?
Well, they think he may. They're giving him a transfusion.
Oh, with your blood. Oh, what a story.
No, please don't use that.
Oh, yes, we know how you feel about all.
I'm just doing what anyone else would do. He was my friend. I owed him everything.
Well, of course, but you're a hero. You don't know how people feel about Garrick Drury.
Don't I?
Oh, incidentally, Mr. Scales, we hear you sold the screen rights on the play.
Oh, no, not yet. It was, well, we've been talking it over tonight. Yes? But if anything happens to Mr. Drury...
You mean we won't sell, huh?
If anything happens to Gary, Bitter Laurel will never be performed again. My hands were wet and cold, and I could feel the perspiration running down my back. My head was light, and I seemed to be walking on air. The voices of the reporters were distant and indistinct. I felt the sudden need to lie down, to rest, sleep. And the door to Gary's dressing room opened, and I saw the doctor standing there. His face and his voice were blurred.
Doctor, will you come, please?
What is it?
He's complaining of a pain in his back. He did almost immediately. We started the transfusion. He's asking for you.
Of course.
I don't understand. We all did our best. So much hemorrhage, shock, cardiac strain. It's always a gamble, you see, when the operation is left so late. Sometimes there is a particular idiosyncrasy. I should have preferred a direct test, but that's no good if the patient dies while you wait to make sure.
Mr. Drury.
What is?
Where's Bran?
Oh, his son?
No, he's on the study.
He'll be here in a minute, Mr. Drury.
They're waiting. Bran. Fetch Bran. The curtain must go up.
Yes,
he's dead.
Why did he die, Doctor?
Blood transfusion, but I don't understand it. Mr. Scales is a type 4, universal donor. Still, there are sometimes personal idiosyncrasies.
Yes,
I caught Walter's gaze and followed it. He was staring fascinated at the plate, which still stood on the table.
The rose. That one there that smudged from the firing. I remember noticing. It was originally on my right... Now it's on my left.
Ridiculous.
You did it. You turned the plate around because you knew that my blood would save him and that yours
would... Oh, don't be a fool, Walter. I lost everything by his death. Why should I want him dead?
You hated him. I've known. I've seen it all the time. Because of the plague.
Walter.
You killed him.
Don't be a fool. You fantastic. What coroner? Coroner's jury?
No.
What coroner? And it happened. The roaring in my ears, the spastic constriction of my stomach. The room began to teeter and whirl. I staggered toward a chair. I could hear the doctor faintly still from the long, long way off.
What's the matter? Easy now. It's shock.
No, here, my side, where the car hit me.
Where? Show me.
Just... here.
Good Lord, man. Why didn't you tell us? You're hurt. Walters.
Yes, sir.
Tell them to bring in the stretcher from the ambulance. Quickly, man.
Yes, sir.
It's ironic. when the car hit me, it was an injury to the spleen. The spleen, think of it. So you see, all the time I was giving Gary blood for a transfusion, I was bleeding to death inside myself. Ironic, isn't it? Death from shock and loss of blood. They gave me a transfusion, too. Too late. But I wouldn't have to die, they said. I would have lived if I hadn't given my blood to kill Gary Drury.
Suspense, presented by Autolite. Tonight's star, Joseph Cotton.
Simmer down, Harlow. No more of those explosive riddles.
I'm exploding with good news, Hap. The news that Autolite makes more than 400 products for cars, trucks, planes, and boats in 28 plants, coast to coast. These include complete electrical systems used as original equipment on many makes of America's finest cars. Batteries, spark plugs, generators, coils, distributors, electric windshield wipers, starting motors, bullseye sealed beam headlights. All engineered to fit together perfectly, work together perfectly, because they're a perfect team. So, folks, don't accept electrical parts supposed to be as good. Ask for and insist on Autolite original factory parts at your neighborhood service station, car dealer, garage, or repair shop. Remember, you're always right with Autolite. Next Thursday for Suspense, our star will be Cary Grant. The play is called Salvage, and it is, as we say,
a tale well calculated to keep you in suspense.
Tonight's Suspense play was produced and edited by William Spear and directed by Norman MacDonald. Music for Suspense is composed by Lucian Morawek and conducted by Lud Gluskin. Blood Sacrifice was adapted for radio by Malcolm Meacham from the short story by Dorothy Sayers. Joseph Cotton may currently be seen in the Carol Reed production, The Third Man, a David O. Selznick release.
Ah.
You can buy Autolite Stayful batteries, Autolite resistor or regular spark plugs, Autolite electrical parts at your neighborhood Autolite dealers. Switch to Autolite. Good night.
This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Has come to an end here at Erie House Radio. Dave, have we got something to learn from this one, too?
We can.
Oh,
I guess.
You're ready, I am.
Yeah, why not?
Why not? Let's give it a shot. Whoops. There we go.
Newspapers are just as good an advertising medium as radio.
Sure, driving home at night, you can enjoy your newspaper as it lies there on the seat. And there's another good thing about newspapers. You can read them while you're riding.
Newspapers are just as good an advertising...
Yes, they are. Erie House Radio proudly presents A Garrulous Moral of the Story.
Apologies to Brother Gar again and again and again. It's always good to give blood, except when it isn't.
There we go. Am I still breaking up here?
Yes, you are.
All right, well. Erie House Radio proudly presents another garrulous moral of the story. Apologies to Gar. Always, if you're doing a blog, be nice, don't tick off CW, and have your finger hovered over the right soundbite. There you go. There you have it.
There you go.
Quite right.
Here we go.
Time for one last set of blood facts, Dane facts.
Wait a minute. Not yet. We don't. Here we go. We'll do this one because it's nearby.
Missed that one. Blood fact. Blood consists of a yellow liquid, which are present in blood. And Dave fact, if you have too much of this yellow liquid in your blood, it makes you a chicken. All right. And blood fact. Every 2 seconds, someone in the world will need blood. Dave fact, I had no idea there were that many vampires in the world. Blood fact, one pint of blood can save 3 lives. Dave fact, one pint of vodka can save even more lives because after a pint, you can't find your car. Blood fact, blood plasma is primarily made up of water. 90% of plasma is water. Dave fact, no wonder I have to get up and pee so much in the middle of the night. There you go. And that one is quite appropriate.
It could be worse. You could have a prostate the size of a Hindenburg. But I digress. Enough of my problems. Oh, God. We have time. A little bit, anyway.
Okay.
We have a little bit of time here.
Certainly. A little something.
How would you feel about a tad bit of music, mayhap?
Yeah,
indeed,
go ahead.
Indeed.
All right,
anyone have a nickel?
Reach in that wood nickel there.
Yes, but I have no sense. Here we go, right into the slot. roll my ass off here.
Sweetheart's a word you use too lightly. It's more than just a word to me. And honey, I resent it slightly. So hold that kiss. Remember this. Don't sweetheart me. If you don't mean it, don't talk sweet words. If they're not true, don't tear my heart like it was paper. Because my heart loves only you. You can't go around sweethearting others and then pretend that I'm yours exclusively. Love must be true, mean what you're saying, unless you do. Don't sweetheart me. I'm yours exclusively. Love must be true, mean what you're saying, unless you do. Don't sweetheart me.
There you go, a little Vincent, not to be confused with Trini Lopez.
Here you go.
Don't sweetheart me.
Very apropos for Valentine's month.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Fun little ditty there. Just you know, even you know, telling somebody off in big band style sounds cool. You know?
Yes, it does. Oh, good music, good music, and you know we're gonna have more. We're gonna do another music show in the future, but more about the more immediate future, which is next weekend. We're getting strange, man. Not some strange, but strange. Nothing could be stranger than hanging out. Hanging around with Casey Crane, photographer, Theater 5, Mysterious Traveler, and then Saturday, CBS Radio Mystery Theater. That's right, a little stranger danger next weekend. Dave, any sightings of weirdness really bad? Or
outside of my regular areas and stuff, but no, I think they're waiting for me to put some new stuff together for our friends at the Vortex, and I've got some things in mind, but I'm getting there.
That's okay, because you can check out Dave on Roku, can't you?
You can, and Uncle Pete's Betamax TV. Check us out there. Got several movies up there, including one with Dale, Kathleen, and myself from Olmsted Ice.
Yeah, with Blonde Ice for the movie, and that's on Roku on the Roku channel again. Beta TV, run by Uncle Pete. Who does shows that are submitted to the Vortex. You can see Uncle Pete there. Cool guy. I got to know him not that too long before he started appearing on Vortex. Not so oddly enough. But I digress. We'll be back next weekend. Hopefully the timing.
The castle lights are growing dim. There's no one left but me and him.
And her.
When next we meet in Frankenstone. Don't come alone.
Wow. Yeah. Quite by accident, the timing came out.
Yeah.
And CW, you showed up just in time to keep me from going totally out of control. Good work.
Oh, yep, had to corral you in there for just a tad.
Yeah.
Yep.
Dale doesn't have a Jiminy Cricket, so he needs help.
Yes. You can be my Jiminy Cricket when you're here.
Very good. Or more to my liking, cheese and crackers.
Yes.
Yeah. Blomtown has been a little frustrating this weekend, but hey, we made it through.
Yeah, I don't know if it's my internet connection or what that's made me a bit garbled at times. I can't hear that on my end, so thanks, guys, for letting me know when that happens.
Well, I don't know.
I was surprised, you know.
Or Block Talk, or all of the above, or I don't know.
Who knows?
Kicked me off last week.
Yeah, it kicked me off. It does do that sometimes.
It's been naughty. Naughty.
Oh, okay. You're in the fish pond again, Dale.
I'm in the fish pond. Being dragged under by the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Captain Nemo. Calling Captain Nemo.
There you go. Who's your favorite Captain Nemo? CW?
Actually, everyone thinks of James Mason in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, the Disney movie. But in all honesty, I know the movie was totally panned. The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, I can't remember the name of the actor.
Oh, yeah. He was played so differently as an Arabic fella.
Yeah,
yes,
Arabic
it was,
or
yeah.
Hindi. I enjoyed
or
that.
Hindi, yes.
That portrayal very much.
Yep.
I thought that was an extremely underrated film.
It was. I just don't think it was marketed well, which is why it just didn't go over.
I guess I agree because it had great action, great characters, a decent cast. That was good.
I love how it was filled with all these literary characters. It was just fabulous. I guess Sean Connery had turned down a bunch of films, superhero films. He just didn't understand them. So he decided, since they were making so much money, he'd do this one. He still didn't understand it, but you don't have to when you have his acting ability, I guess.
No.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, that doesn't make any sense to me either. I mean, he lived long enough then. How could he not have one of his agents that just sit down, Sean, and just read it. You've seen a comic book before. They're not new. They've been around for a bit.
Yes.
You know?
They won't hurt you.
I mean, if Marlon Brando could kowtow and be Jor-El in a 1970s movie, you can suck it up and do it.
That's right. Frederick Wortham was wrong. Comic books are fine. They won't hurt you.
No, they won't. I mean,
yeah.
Laurence Olivier was Van Helsing in, 1979 Dracula? Did a wonderful job about that. So, I know Dracula's a comic, but...
There's an underappreciated Nemo that I like rather well, and I don't recall the actor's name. But in the Ray Harryhausen animated version of Mysterious Island, which is a bit of a sequel to 20,000 Leagues, they had a pretty good Nemo in that one.
Hmm.
A bit of a pastiche of James Mason to some degree, but yet not. He made the character his own in that movie. And he wasn't in it very long. Nemo only shows up at the end of that flick, like maybe in the last half hour.
Right, yeah.
But if you haven't seen it or haven't seen it in a while, I highly recommend it. It takes place during Civil War America, and which I believe the novel did as well. And
we played the mystery. If you're listening here in the archive, we did play a Radio Mystery Theater version a short time ago. So go back in the archive and catch it there. They did a pretty decent edition of that.
Yes, they did.
Outstanding. I don't suppose suppose they did. They probably have done radio plays about 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, the Jules Verne classic, and all that.
Dave, that's your wheelhouse.
I can think of one that was done here. Now they may have done it over in the UK, where they've been so much. They've got so much more radio they did and continue to do, but it's not really out there and available like ours is. The one that we have, I don't know that it's even complete. So I think there was a Mysterious Island series out there also. I'm not sure that one is complete, which is weird, because you'd think if you have one, you'd have the whole set, because it was serialized, you know?
Indeed. And I'm wondering, I may be grasping at straws here, eco-friendly straws, that is, keep the ocean clean. But I'm wondering if Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, during their time traveling or whatever else it was, did they perhaps encounter Nemo or the...
I don't think so. That would have been a cool idea. That is a tremendous idea, by the way.
Yeah. You have to write that up, CW.
Yeah. Write a pastiche type like novelette there. That would be cool. I would read it. I would buy it, just because you wrote it. And it's a cool idea.
I can think about that.
I think we're stimulating someone's creative. Corpuscles or whatever. I think I am fading out.
I think it's CW is turn to jump into the fishbowl.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah. So Dale, it isn't just you. I think it's Blog Talk Radio once again at its finest.
Yep.
All right. All right. Well, I think we're having trouble here. So I think perhaps we should have CW. Lead us out of here with Jimmy Durante, because we just can't hear each other.
Understood. So without further ado, Mr. Durante, quickly, before we fade out, would you please?
Your cue, Dale.
Night. Good night. Good night.
Good night.
It's time to say good night.
I heard that one.
Good night. For this sake, but good night. We've had a few laughs, and it's time for toodaloo. Aribo, up we sing, and ink-a-tink-a-doo. Good night. Good night.
Good night, folks. And good night, Mrs. Calabash.
Ladies and gentlemen, poison doesn't always come in bottles, and it isn't always marked with the skull and crossbones of danger. Poison can take the form of words and phrases and acts, the venom of racial and religious hatred. Here in the United States, perhaps more than ever before, we must learn to recognize the poison of prejudice and to discover the antidote to its dangerous effects. Evidences of racial and religious hatred in our country place a potent weapon in the hands of our enemies, providing them with the ammunition of criticism. Moreover, group hatred menaces the entire fabric of democratic life. As for the antidote, you can fight prejudice, first by recognizing it for what it is, and second, by actively accepting or rejecting people on their individual worth, and by speaking up against prejudice and for understanding. Remember, freedom and prejudice can't exist side by side. If you choose freedom, fight prejudice.